and welcome to the Unhinged History Podcast, the podcast where last week Teresa talked way too long about Marie Laveau, and I failed to leave any time on the recording schedule to let Angie tell her story, and she came back because she's really got something to say. I'm Teresa. I'm the talker, and that's...
I'm Angie, and I do have something to say, but it honestly, I'm still glad that you took the whole time because I couldn't get my mouth up off the floor.
I mean,
so I wouldn't have been able to tell my story anyway.
It was just one of those stories where I couldn't stop compulsively learning. And then everything I learned, I was like, oh my gosh, this pairs well. This is what we've learned before. We've seen this paradigm. We've seen this happen. And then it's like, oh, I love everything about her. She's a saint.
I have been thinking nonstop. Like, I am so, I don't know, like, where you cast your vote for sainthood. Like, I don't know how that works, but I'm not Catholic.
I would convert to Catholicism if, and I hear, Pope, hear me, if you want Teresa for Catholicism, I'm going to need the patron saint statue and medal of Olga of Kiev. And I don't know if that includes, like, is it a fire pit with cutouts of her silhouette? Because that's what I feel like it should be. And I then
or her holding a bird. I mean, I like that.
Oh, like I would be okay with that. Yeah, that would be the garden statue.
Yeah.
You put
that in a little alcove in your garden. Yeah.
And then I'm going to need Marie Laveau canonized stat. And I'm going to need the same accoutrements for her so I can celebrate her sainthood.
Accoutrement, please and thank you.
Yeah. So that's what I need. I mean, and then I'm your girl. I can stand up and sit down during mass with the best of them. Especially now with the new knee.
The very first Catholic mass that I actually remember attending, because I'd gone to a Catholic wedding before, but I don't really remember, like, what we did, how
right.
It worked, what was involved. But the very first mass I attended, I was like 8 months pregnant with Ethan.
Oh.
And like just expecting it to be
standard. You sit in the pew,
yeah.
You listen, you stand
right.
up, you shake hands, you sit back down, you listen, sing a couple of hymns and walk out the door.
That's exactly what I thought it was. And my husband, who has grown up, so he is not a Catholic, but he's grown up very much in the Catholic sphere.
Okay.
So he tells me on the way there, he's like, okay,
here's
this
your knee
is
pads.
How the service is going to work. Pretty much. You, however, because you're pregnant, don't have to abide by these same rules. Like, they don't expect you to. And I'm like, okay. And he's like explaining the sit down, stand up, the this, the that. And I'm like, okay, got it. Except for what he doesn't tell me is we are in the front row. Because he's the grandson of the gentleman with whom they're giving mass for.
I imagine at some point in the service, you are on your back, arms and legs in the air like a beetle because you can't get back up.
I looked at Ian and was like, you said I didn't have to abide by the same rules, but we're in row number one. So
yeah.
I feel like it would be disrespectful if I did not. So I did. Like, I handle it like a boss. And thankfully, his was a much more scaled down service. So it was kind of like getting your feet in the water a little bit to understand it. But I have since attended other services where I'm like, oh, okay, we're sitting, we're standing, we're sitting, we're standing, we're sitting. Got it? Okay.
I did not get any preparation. And I went to a couple of masses for certain things I was in the periphery of a sphere of in high school. And it was like, oh, okay, this is like, nobody explained the game, the rules to the hokey pokey. And now I'm in the middle of the dance floor. And I didn't know
this.
To throw myself around. And now we're chanting. What are we chanting? I don't know. Just mumble along.
I like watermelon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're absolutely beautiful, and I understand the draw to it. Like, it makes perfect sense. The whole atmosphere of the Kit and Caboodle, it's absolutely gorgeous. The sitting and the standing definitely threw me for a big loop the first time.
I mean, I will say, I didn't realize it until just now. Being autistic is like not knowing what Catholicism is and going to mass and nobody having explained the rules and then trying to just fumble your way along while everybody has a clearly different rule book.
I agree with you.
That's exactly what it feels like.
Do you know what you just made me think of? Ethan's coach tried to get him to shoot with both eyes, and Ethan told him he can't do it that way. And Ian goes, God bless him, he has to close one of his eyes so he can shut off half the ADHD.
He only needs the HD. We can shut the 80 down. He wants to
We
see in
just
high def.
pretty much, And Ethan was like, my dad's not wrong. And because he can't shoot with both eyes open. I think that's absolutely, I had no clue that that was a problem he was trying to work through or that he had, because I've been watching him do it for years and I never noticed he had one eye closed. And his when he told the coach that, his coach was like, I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. I mean, because that's one of those like, boy, that's not how things work. And meanwhile, you guys are both like, oh no, that's legit
Well,
how things work.
if listen, I don't know if you've ever seen children before, but they make it work. Like, he's got it. Like,
Right. Yeah.
he's good, sir. We're not going to tell him to do it any different because it's what works. So the coach is like,
Anyhow, tell me your story.
I'm going to start with my sources, and I'm just going to apologize to you now. There are 700 of them.
Oh, good. You don't just want to clump them and be like, we'll dump the rest in show notes or something.
I mean, like, I could do that because some of them are just there because I had to look up something else. Like, I needed to fully understand a different thing, you know, and related to it. But the bulk of my sources are the library at Yale. There
Okay.
is, I know, right? There is a, I think I'm going to say this wrong. Arstotechnia.com article, history researcher says it's the most plagiarized guide to women's health, by Annalee Newitz from September of 2017.
This is going to make me so angry already.
No, I promise you it's not. Well, it might, but it's not what you think it is.
Okay.
So the lindahall.org, which is a type of collection of it's a library that has science, engineering, and tech involved in it. So they have like a scientist of the day article that they do, like, so, you know, like an interesting topic today. Here's that topic. A New Yorker article, which I thought was really fun. A Britannica.com, of course. Discover magazine. And I listened to a podcast on Atlas Obscura about this, but okay, now that I've told you that my biggest source is Yale, I'm going to tell you about quite possibly the greatest hoax in printmaking. Or maybe not. We don't know. I'm going to tell you
Oh.
about the Voynich manuscript. Have you ever heard of the Voynich manuscript?
This feels like in the deep archives of my brain, there is a file, but I'm going to get the spinning ball for a bit.
Okay. You have sent the librarian on a wild goose chase?
Yes.
Okay, well. So the Atlas Obscura podcast is called A Strange Medieval Document Housed in a Stunning Modern Library, and I just think I love that so much. It made me so happy. And in that podcast, one of the speakers makes the statement, and I absolutely loved it. You never forget your first time seeing the Voynich. That's for sure. And here's the thing. I actually remember the first time I ever saw pictures of it. I was like 10 years old. And I still haven't forgot. So I thought that was very funny that I was like, oh yeah, that's true, because I was 10 the first time I saw pictures of it, and I have not forgot about it. It lives rent-free in my brain. So yeah.
Well, okay, now go on, because my
Okay.
library is scurry or my librarian's scurrying through the dark corridors.
Okay. So, sitting in the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University is a book. It's a manuscript that measures roughly 8.9 by 6.3 inches. It contains 102 heavily illustrated parchment folios, which averages out to be about 234 pages. Quote, "It's not fancy. It doesn't have gold. It's not in a fancy binding. It's a messy, dirty object. It was made to be used." That quote is from Lisa Fakin Davis. She's a medievalist who works with the Codex at the Beinecke. Additionally, she points out that the binding is old and busted and probably not the original, but that kind of only adds to the fun. It's possible that the binding was most likely changed in the late 1800s when the Jesuit order, their books were all being consolidated and like sent to one abbey or sent to Rome. So they were only allowed to keep their personal manuscripts, but if they had manuscripts that were more elaborate or of any kind of value, they were all supposed to be consolidated and sent away. So it's believed that the Jesuit order, having not really known what this manuscript was, recovered it themselves so they could keep it.
Oh,
But we don't know.
I'd rebind my
So,
books so I could keep them.
right, I fully agree with you. So, like I said, everything else that's fancy or anything that wasn't solely belonging to that specific order was consolidated and it goes to Rome. What's really interesting is not only are what do they know that it was rebound, there's definitely pages missing. Discover Magazine has this to say. It is similar in size to an average paperback, 6 by 9 inches. The book burst at the seams, brimming with words and pictures of peculiar plants, strange stars, and bathing female figures. At around 200,
Sorry.
yeah.
I just originally I was like, is this gonna end up like, well, the missing pages were porn.
We don't know.
But it, you know
Maybe.
what? Sorry. That was me being a that was
You're
me being a
Well, when you see some of these pictures, you might not be too far, okay? At around page 230, 232 pages, the book bore no indication of its author, and like I said before, it lacks the luster and the metal leaf seen in many manuscripts from the Illuminated Age, which only increases its intrigue, and its writing was wholly incomprehensible, causing Voynich, who we'll get into in a moment, to conclude that the tome was written in code. Okay. So I'm going to
Oh.
tell you a little bit more about the book, and then I'm going to tell you about some of the key players in this whole fiasco. According to the illustrations, its contents are they're divided into six sections, which we think include botany, astronomy, astrology, biology, cosmology, and pharmaceutical. And another section, which contains a continuous text with decorative markings at the beginning of a number of short entries. Those short entries are thought to be recipes, whether they're recipes for food or recipes for medicinal use. I would have to think it's more recipes for medicinal use would be my thought, but who knows? Okay, so you're probably sitting there thinking, okay, this book sounds like it could be like maybe a medical field journal or something basic. Well, no.
Go on.
There are actually a number of things that make this book incredibly special, starting with the fact that it is written in a language we can't decipher or even come close to understanding. However, it is fair to point out that according to Lisa, who has worked with the manuscript, only about 1% of the written record from the medieval period have survived to the present day. So, who knows if the language that it's written in is just one we haven't seen written before,
Okay.
or if, or since, or if it's from originally a language that didn't have a written word, we're unclear. Additionally, Its location of origin is just as hard to understand. In 2009, it was carbon dated to the 15th century, roughly between the years of 1404 and 1438. So you're if it was created in 1404, I mean, that gives us just a few hundred years to try to figure out the history of this book, right?
I mean, I'm here for all of this right now. What was Baby Angie reading
Right?
about?
I know, right? I was 10 years old. So in the last 100 so or so years, it's been the source of a ton of inquest and curiosity, partially because it itself is so mysterious, and partially because the trip it took to resurface to the 20th century. And here's where we enter Wilfrid Vonage, the namesake of the manuscript. He was born November 12, 1865, in Poland, and he spends his youth as a Polish revolutionary. At one point, he is captured and sent to Siberia. Somehow, he gets out of Siberia and he moves to London. He settles down, he gets married, and he becomes an antiquarian and a rare bookseller. Now,
Okay, so far, just those factoids make him the most interesting man alive.
right? And there's a lot of theories about him, and unfortunately, we don't have a ton of information. But for me, the idea that you grew up a Polish revolutionary and then you spent time in freaking Siberia of all the weird places, and then you just decide after you get out of it that you're going to move to London and become an old bookseller, like that's so random to me. So there are people that believe that his bookselling
Spy, spy,
was a front.
spy.
Either a spy or possibly other political or revolutionary type scheming happened in the back end of the bookstore kind of thing. But we don't know.
Books in the front, business in the back.
Right? Just like the mullet. That's what a lot of people think. I don't know, but the more I read about him, the more I'm kind of like, huh. Yeah, you know what? That actually checks. So, like I said, he gets married, he becomes a real rare bookseller. His London headquarters does so well that he is able to open a branch in New York City. Now, I'm going to say this. The Library of Yale was my biggest source, but what's really interesting about this manuscript is even the most credible sources, like the library at Yale, this manuscript is so its history is so convoluted and so wild and so unknown that it's hard to fully understand and put two and two together for any of it, which is only adds to its intrigue, right? So
Okay.
there are some that believe between night that in 1910 or in 1912, pick your year, but somewhere in those 2 years, Voynich buys 30 manuscripts from a Jesuit, cooperation out of Italy. There are a lot of people that don't believe that's actually how he came across this set of books, but anyway, he buys these 30 manuscripts from the Jesuits in Italy. That's the most cited belief, that he just purchases them. There are those that believe otherwise, but who really knows exactly what he does? He comes into acquisition of these books, and he's able to kind of disperse some of the other ones. In fact, there are many universities in the US that actually have a Voynich manuscript because he purchased from these 30 of the Jesuit books, and most of them are like Thomas Aquinas and
Yeah.
other religious works, like, right? Okay.
So
Now
Voynich
remember though,
manuscript isn't necessarily the singular, it is the group of manuscripts that he purchased. And then this one is the most crazy.
Voynichy. Yeah.
Voynichy.
So
Okay.
you can have a Voynich manuscript, but it won't be the Voynich manuscript. So
Okay.
Discover
Okay.
Magazine has this. Go ahead.
No, that was just me going, okay. Like I gathering
You
my
got it?
thoughts,
Okay.
lining up my ducks.
Okay. Voynich Magazine has a great quote about this. Bundled in a collection of manuscripts set to be sold to the Vatican, Voynich may have been a little bit reluctant to reveal its true origins. So it's possible he procured some stuff that was not meant for sale to him.
And wait, you're saying he sold them or he was going to sell them to the Vatican?
No, he bought them and they were on their way to be sent to the Vatican.
Gotcha. So moving truck is getting ready to head to Rome, and he's like, how about this crate right here? How about
That's the vibe I
50
get. That's the
lira?
vibe I get.
Okay.
But again, no one really knows for sure because he was never really forthcoming on the information. But
I
anyway,
want to be mysterious like that.
you know, right? Once it enters his charge, it's not forgotten about again. I mean, it goes for, the Jesuit priests have it for hundreds of years and no one really knows anything of it, right? But once he gets it, people start to take notice. He thinks it seems to be to him of some European origin, and the manuscript has a letter folded into the front of it from, I'm going to try so hard to say these next couple of names correct. Johann Marcus Marci Acronlin, who was a 17th century Bohemian physical scientist and the personal physician to the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II. This letter is written in 1665, and it's addressed to a polymath called Athenius Kircher. And Kircher is in him of himself like the one of the most interesting people I think to have ever graced Europe with his brain.
You know,
He learns Greek
let's
and
zoom back a
Hebrew.
second because I am a fan of any time anybody is called a polymath. It is a word we do not use often or often enough anymore.
Yeah. You want to hear about what Britannica has to say about this gentleman?
Yes.
Because it's a doozy. He learns Greek and Hebrew at the Jesuit school in Fluda. He pursued scientific and humanistic studies at Paderborn, Cologne, and Colbenez, and in 1628 was ordained at Mainz. He fled the increasing factional and dynastic fighting in Germany as part of the Thirty Years' War, and after occupying various academic positions at Avignon, settled in 1634 in Rome. There he remained for most of his life, functioning as kind of a one-man intellectual clearinghouse for culture and scientific information, gleaned not only from European sources, but also from the far-flung network of Jesuit missionaries. He was especially interested in ancient Egypt and is sometimes regarded as the founder of Egyptology for his attempt to decipher hieroglyphics and other related Egyptian phenomena.
Whoa.
So there's a book, and I don't cite my I didn't I should have saved the link for it, but there's a book on him, and I believe it's called The Last Man Who Knew Everything. And I am dying to get my hands on it and read it because this guy sounds so cool. Like, I want to know everything this man knew, right? Like,
I'll cover
whoa.
him next week just to torment you.
Thanks. I'm here for it, you jerk. So the letter that's sent to him that we now have, folded up in the beginning of the manuscript is basically presenting Kircher this manuscript. And because of this, it's believed and pretty solidly believed that the book at one point did belong in the libraries of the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II. It's believed that if Rudolf did indeed own it, I absolutely love this. One hypothesis was that he purchased it for 600 ducats, which is around 90,000 today,
Dude.
from the mathematician and occultist John Dee. Now, I don't know if you know who John Dee is. He was many things, but I'd like to point out that he was also the court astronomer and the advisor to Lizzie I. So this book is changing hands. Like, it has seen Europe. Like, it's going places.
Okay.
John Dee is another interesting fellow that I would love to know more about. So the Beinecke has this to say on it. Like its contents, the history of ownership of the Voynich manuscript is contested and filled with some gaps. The codex belonged to Emperor Rudolf II of Germany, the Holy Roman Emperor, who lived from 1576 to 1612, who purchased it for 600 gold ducats, believing it was the work of Roger Bacon. It was very likely that Emperor Rudolph acquired the manuscript from the English astrologer John Dee. Dee apparently owned a manuscript along with a number of other Roger Bacon manuscripts. In addition, Dee stated that he had had 630 ducats in October 1586, as his son noted that Dee, while in Bohemia, owned a book containing nothing but hieroglyphics, which book his father bestowed much time upon. But I could not hear that he ever could make it out. Emperor Rudolph seems to have then given the manuscripts to Jacobs Horsicky de Tempnes. I'm sorry if I ruined that name. I've had such a hard time with it. But it's believed that Emperor Rudolph seems to have given it to him as an exchange based on the inscription is visible when the codex is put under ultraviolet light. You can kind of see the name in the book, okay? So like I said, it's going back and forth. At one point we know it's presented to Kircher, and in 1912, Wilfrid M. Vonage purchases the manuscript from the De Jesuit College. He purchases it and then he can't get rid of it. So his he I'm the general thought is that he sees this book and he thinks, because at the time and still even today, medical codex, medical manuscript, or scientific manuscript from the medieval era is something of great interest to a lot of academics and to a lot of scholars in general. So a lot of people think that he's thinking he's going to get a pretty penny for this because it's so lovely and it is what it is, and it's got all this great information in it, only no one can read it. So he's kind of stuck with it. At one point, after World War II, the code breakers who break the Enigma code and bazillion other code breakers from around the world gather and spend their weekends trying to break this code, and they cannot. And that rocked my brain. Like, you're telling me the people that broke the Enigma couldn't handle
The
this?
Bletchley Park
That's insane
girls.
to me. Right. Like, code breakers from all over the world, linguists from all over the world gather together and they just cannot figure this out. So, when he passes away, when Wilfrid Voynich passes away, he leaves the book to his wife. And his wife also can't get rid of it. And so she, long story short, it goes from hand to hand until this gentleman called H.P. Krauss had purchased it from the estate of Ethel, Voynich's wife,
That is
and
the
decides
quintessential
eventually,
old-timey wife name.
is it not, right? He eventually just decides, you know what, like I can't get rid of this book, and he gives it to the Beinecke Library, and that's where it stayed since 1969, which I think is crazy. Now, I will say this, there is a lot to learn about the Holy Roman Emperors at this time because my sources were very conflicting. They say that both Tempinus and the first gentleman I mentioned, trying to get his correct name, oh my goodness, I lost it, Marcy, that they were both Rudolph's court doctors. However, that can't be accurate because Rudolph died when one of them was like 5 years old.
He was ahead of his
So
time. He was the Doogie Howser of court doctors.
it's true, but here you go. So I'm a little bit confused about that part. I've spent several days trying to figure out like exactly the timeline here, but because no one really knows anything solid about this book, there's no real solid timeline to 1969, where it's been housed in the Beinecke Library and people have access to it. So anyway, back to Voynich though. He thinks the work to be that of the medieval alchemist Roger Bacon, which is also what the Emperor Rudolph believed as well.
Okay.
Except for that was debunked when the carbon dating pointed out that it was created in the early 1400s, and Bacon had been dead by 1292.
Yeah, that makes it kind of difficult.
Makes it a little bit hard. I mean, unless he's coming back from the dead to write it, but
Which, I mean, that increases the mystique.
absolutely. I mean, a dead man wrote a book. I'm here for it. So, like I said, it's written in some sort of cipher. It goes through this huge list. It makes it to the Beinecke, where it still resides today. And what's really awesome about the Beinecke is you can actually go online and see every single page. The Beinecke made a facsimile of it and then uploaded it to the internet. And you can even purchase and see high def images. So anybody can have a shot at trying to figure out what this book is. And I think that's super cool. One of the other things that was noticed in the research of this topic is that Miss Lisa, who I had mentioned earlier, who talked about you don't forget the first time you've ever seen it and things like that. She, being the medievalist that she is, has spent a great deal of time on this book. She has come to the conclusion that not one, but perhaps at least five people worked together to make the manuscript. And I think that's crazy because once I show you the pictures, you're going to be like, pourquoi? Like, what? So allow me at this time to describe some of the things inside. Like I mentioned before, it contains at least six different categories: botany, astronomy, astrology, biology, cosmology, and pharmaceutical. And I'm going to give you the Beinecke's description. Quote, "The botanicals contain drawings of 113 unidentified plant species. The astronomical and astrological drawings include astral charts with radiating circles, suns and moons, zodiac symbols such as the Pisces fish, a bull Taurus, and an archer Sagittarius. Nude females emerging from pipes or chimneys and courtly figures. The biological section is made up of drawings of miniature female nudes, mostly with swelled abdomens, immersed or wading in fluids and oddly interacting with interconnecting tubes and capsules. The cosmology shows an elaborate array of nine cosmological medallions, many drawn across several folded folios and depicting possible geographical forms, and the pharmaceutical drawings, of which there are 100 different species of medicinal herbs and roots, portrayed with jars or vessels in red, blue, or green. And the recipe section is continuous pages of text, possibly recipes with star-like flowers marking each entry of the margin." Okay. I love this part. Lisa says people get really excited about the star charts because that's where the aliens come in.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is also where one of the more wild theories about the book come from. Are you ready for quite possibly the wildest theory about this book?
So this is going to be the part where I bring it up to Hubs later on after I walk away from this recording, and he goes, "Oh yeah, that was on Ancient Aliens. You remember the guy with the hair? It's aliens."
It probably, I wouldn't put it past him, actually. So, one of the most favorite theories out there is that it was created by a young alien of the female gender whose family was here for whatever reason. And when they left, I don't know, to go home from the vacation to planet Earth or whatever, she accidentally leaves her journal behind. That is one of the most favored theories.
Favored among
So, a gentleman.
academics, favored among alien researchers who live in mommy's basement.
I kind of think that one. Academics
Okay.
do not credit the alien
Weigh in on
theory,
this?
but
Okay.
they do get a laugh out of it. They do find it entertaining, but it is definitely not what they think. I mean, I can't speak for all of them, but from the few that I listened to and the handful that I read, they do not give it any credit.
Bessie, having
But
done enough surveys, I can tell you there is always a percentage who say option C, the batshit insane theory.
aliens. The hair comes out and everything, right? So, a
Yep.
gentleman called Nick Paling at CipherMysteries.com compiled together some favorite theories from around time in the world, and I'm going to hit you with a few of them because there are some doozies. Eric von Daniken covers the Voynich
Eric
manuscript in
von
his
Daniken,
2000.
he is an ancient aliens researcher. He's a talking head.
Yeah.
Go on.
Okay, yeah. So trust me, because this is very talking headish. In his manuscript, or excuse me, in his 2009 book, History is Wrong, he links it with the Book of Enoch and a whole load of other things.
Okay.
Beatrice Gwyn from Dublin thinks it's a 16th century hygiene manual written in left to right mirrored Middle High German.
But
Okay,
wait, don't we know
that's.
it predates that? So she's wrong just off the bat from dates.
Off the bat on dates, yes, but as far as idea goes, maybe she might be onto something, right?
Okay.
William Romaine Newblood sententiously claimed that the manuscript was written by Roger Bacon in a multi-layered micrographic cipher and described using telescopes to view galaxies. I don't see that when I look at the pictures. I'm not sure why he would think that, but what do I know? Richard Santacoma claims that the manuscript was probably written by Cornelius Dribble, or perhaps was a stage prop constructed by Francis, not Roger Bacon. Okay.
That is okay.
Interesting.
Automatically, having been involved in drama, if it was designed to be a stage prop, the interior pages of those books are blank, or they're just the recovered Betty Crocker cookbook. Like, they're not what you think they are.
And if you're going as another child of theater, if they're going to show any pictures to the audience, it's only the pages that they're going to show that have pictures on them.
Yes.
Everything else is blank. Right?
Right.
Okay. Maybe medieval playmakers were far more they dealt with closer audiences. I
Ornate.
don't know.
Yeah, very environmental
Yeah,
theater.
definitely
You're up.
ornate. Yeah. Yeah.
I've spent the last 4 years on one prop.
Yeah, exactly. Jim Child, an Indo-European linguist who has been studying the manuscript since the 70s, sees Voynichese as a pronounceable early German language. I do not, but that's what he sees it. So that's what they call the language now in the book is Voynichese. Tim Ackerson is quite sure that your manuscript was written in early Welsh or Old Cornish from the 7th to 8th century, which is also inaccurate by the carbon dating. Unless, of course, you knew the language from the 7th or 8th century in the 14th century and wrote it down, or in the 15th
It's a
century and wrote it
reprint,
down.
yeah.
But
I mean, that's
yeah,
what he's basically saying.
which is a lot of academics' belief is that, back then copyright laws didn't exist the way they do today. So particularly medical texts were often copied and recopied and scribed and things like that, right? So that is a big belief. Dan Bursich claims that the manuscript was written down in enciphered Hebrew by Roger Bacon, and that it describes some type of alien technology from the future for creating DNA with sound.
Okay, so far, let's do a roundup. We're thinking German, we're thinking Welsh, we're thinking Hebrew. Linguistically, those aren't related.
Okay, I'm going to throw one more right at you now. Jim Comiskey believes that the manuscript was a medical book written by the Natal, the language of the Aztecs,
Oh, of
possibly
course,
by
yeah.
Francisco Hernandez.
Because
And he's.
we already know the trade routes between the Aztec Empire and the Jesuit priests in Italy were firmly established.
So those are some of the reigning beliefs. I'm going to show you some pictures and then I'm going to tell you what I think it is. So let me share my screen because this, like I said, I've been enamored with this since I was a kid. And here are some pictures. Can you see them?
Okay. She's showing me very weathered beige pages with some mandrake root kind of imagery. Some very like the script, there's no lines on the pages. The script seems to still flow very like level across the page, like they had some sort of guide. It's like a biology textbook that I would have drawn because it's not like okay, Beatrix Potter, incredible illustrist. And she,
Yeah.
couldn't get into school, but her drawings were impeccable. These are more, you've got a functional understanding of how to draw and not an artistic eye.
That is exactly what experts say, that if this couldn't possibly have been drawn by a botanist because they would have been far more intricate. This is a
Yeah.
functional understanding of the plant. Yeah.
Dang. And see, here I am shooting from the hip. Check me out. I'm going to be a researcher for the Vonix manuscript after this.
So here's some more the artwork. What's really interesting is that we can identify parts of these plants, but not the whole plant that they show in the drawing. They don't grow together the way that we see them in the pages.
So it's like they kind of Frankensteined a lot of these plants together, is what you're saying?
That's what it seems like. But again, some of these plants we've never seen before. So we're it, there's so unclear. Here are the star charts. I love the star charts.
Okay, so these star charts look incredibly in depth. It is really quite beautiful. You've got different color inks. In the writing, they go in circles. Again, you have very uniform level script. This one, you can actually see the lines on which they drew and wrote around. How neato.
Right. Here's the some of the women and a close-up
And
of the script.
the women are not in our very emaciated types that we have today. They have kind of truncated
Hips.
arms, I would say. But they have hips. They've got a fupa. They are women. They're not young girls.
So there are those that believe that the swelled abdomen, this is potentially like a midwife's guide, like
Okay,
a how to
okay.
care, like a women's health, how to care for your body kind of thing.
What to
And then
expect when you're
here's this
expecting?
big,
Which is naked in a bush with other expecting.
yeah. I mean, like I missed that. I don't. No one told me. I got to just go get naked in the
All
pond
right,
with other. Pregnant, like I
I've
wasn't there
stopped
for that,
my
but
monthly cycle. I'm gonna go live with the other pregos, and we're going to sit naked in the forest and just forget about you.
yeah. Now, as I mentioned before, you can go online. There are several places you can actually see every picture, every page, so you can look
Wow.
at them for yourself. Okay. So, I'm going to stop sharing my screen now because I have a couple of my own theories on this, and I'm
Okay.
not. I think it looks like it could be women's writing. I think it looks more Arabic in nature. Have you ever heard of the Nishu?
No, or at least not that I'm
So,
retaining right now.
the Nishu originated around 500 years ago in the Hunan province of China, and it was solely
Wait a
and the
minute, you
work
just went
of.
from Eric or Arabic to Chinese.
Yeah,
Okay.
because you'll see why. So
Okay.
the Nishu was created solely by women for women, and it was a means of communication with one another in this area in a time and place where that was so oppressive to women. So they found a way to communicate amongst themselves in the village, in the province, to swap stories, to swap advice, to swap recipes, whatever. Like, and it
It
is
was their pig
only.
Latin.
Yeah, it is only written by women. It is only known by women. And when I look at these pages and I realize that we have no other documents that match anything that we see in these books, it makes me wonder if maybe it was that. And when you look at the script, it has that flow and that kind of elegance of Arabic writing, like their script, you know? Like if you
Okay.
look at the up close version of it, that's just immediately what my brain thought, but who knows? Like that's just what I think. I think it's women's writing. The other one that jumps to my brain is that perhaps it is the workings of a medieval doctor, but his mind has been taken from him. Perhaps he's dealing with some sort of mental condition, and this
He's
is how he's
had
getting
too
it
much
out.
mercury treatment and has treated too many others with mercury.
Because it is so extensive and it is so thorough, we just don't know what it is. And a lot of the letters repeat themselves in a way that linguists say no written language letters work that way. So to me, it could very well be the inner trappings of a mind that has lost its ability to think linearly in linear fashion.
So he's speaking in drugs.
Yeah, he's
Okay.
speaking in cursive. Yeah, but who knows? The other belief is that it is the greatest, most long game con in the history of books or things in general, that it's just this elaborate hoax that nobody can solve. Perhaps somebody was just trying to make a quick buck off Emperor Rudolph, and so they wrote this book out.
That would take a long time. That's not a quick buck.
Exactly. Which is why the idea of it being a hoax doesn't really make sense to me, but then no other options really make sense either. So we're going to continue studying it, and we're going to continue trying to figure it out. What's really fun about it is, according to the Beinecke, the Voynich gets more mail, emails, phone calls, and has more restraining orders than any object in the library.
Restraining orders? Like against it? Like
That
plaintiff,
people cannot come
wanted
to the
manuscript.
Beinecke anymore.
Okay. Not like the people are like, you keep that thing away from me. It is of the devil and it's just tarnishing my mental health.
No, but when I first read about it as a young person, it was portrayed as this manuscript that drove every person who ever looked at it insane because they couldn't figure it out. I don't think that's accurate. I think that was just to sell the newspaper it was in. But there have met been many people that have studied it, and many people that are still here today to say they've studied it. So here we are. But it does have, there are several people that have restraining orders that cannot come to the Beinecke anymore because of this book.
Could you imagine? This is your first day at the library. Here's the wall of shame. The following patrons are not allowed anywhere near the book. You'd be like, what?
Pardon? Excuse me?
Ma'am, I've worked at many libraries. I've got a career in this. What?
Yeah.
I am to call 911 if I see what? Ma'am, this is a
Yep.
library.
Well, so there are those that have such staunch beliefs that the leadership of the library, that the academics and the scholars have figured it out and refused to give answers. And so they call the library
Oh.
angry and threatening, and so they can't come back.
You know,
Which I think is hilarious. Like,
post-pandemic,
it's a book.
I think that that's accurate. I get it. You know,
Yeah.
pre-COVID, I'd have gone
We've
like,
seen some things.
maybe what? What? And now I'm like, this checks.
It does. It's just Tuesday.
Weary, I hate my life. Yeah, you know, accurate.
I guess I'll throw a dollar at it. Yeah, so that's the Voynich manuscript. It has had quite the history and quite the story that we don't know. Could be a
You
hoax, could be
know,
a medical journal.
there's other books like that somewhere. In a Goodwill, somewhere in, you know, like grandma's basement. And we just don't understand what they are. And
Yep.
it's just like, oh, this was from your third great uncle twice removed and his collection. He was a kook. Who knows where he got half this stuff?
Yeah, and I thought it was so interesting that I didn't realize we only have 1% of what we know was written in the medieval period. That is wild to me.
Well, here's something else to think about. Just because we have all the books we have now digitally and whatnot, doesn't mean we're going to keep them because digital stuff degrades. So.
Like, it's interesting. Yeah. But I mean, like I said, you can go online and you can look at every picture and you can try to figure it out yourself. There are those that have theories that believe, you know, whatever they're going to believe about it. There was one gentleman that was convinced it was a Latin medical manuscript. But essentially he was very quickly shot down. It's not what he thought it was, but when you try so hard to convince yourself of something, you convince yourself of something. He
Yeah,
thought
you'll
he
believe
found
it if you
the
want it.
yeah he thought he found that he broke the code, but he did not. So there you have it. There is my Voynich manuscript in honor of April Fool's Day the other day. Who knows if it's real or not?
Oh, dang, I didn't do a April Fool's Day-ish one, and I went so hard last year with Count Robert and his Castle of Pranks.
I loved Count Robert and his Castle of Pranks.
I
It needs to
mean,
be a
any
movie,
surprise
not a horror
bidet?
movie.
Oh, it couldn't be. It would be this slapstick.
I want Leslie Nielsen. I think it would be
John
awesome.
Candy visiting R Count Robert's Castle of Pranks. I mean, with Automata
Mel
beating you to
Brooks and
death
Leslie
with
Nielsen are
feather
involved.
pillows.
Would be amazing. I am here for it. Yeah, I have been waiting all year to share that story with you. And I was like, listen, we don't know if it's a hoax or not, but April Fool's is upon us. We've just passed it. I thought it would be fun to hit it for that, in honor of
Dang it,
that
I
father.
should have done an April Fool's Day one. To the time machines. I gotta redo it.
I mean, you still have some weeks of the month, and technically, I mean, if you're like my family, you can celebrate Loki Day whenever you want.
I mean, I was born on Loki Day, though. Like, that
Celebrate it when
should.
you wish.
Dang, Nabbit. All right. Well, I've loved this. If you've loved this, if you're thinking, I'm related to the best director who would be able to cover it because Mel Brooks is not available at this time and date, then tell them, get them to listen to the podcast, get them to be enjoyed, enjoyable, enjoying some conjugation of that. You know what? It's been a day. And so on that note, rate, review, subscribe, and goodbye.
Bye.